Talk Show.
Recorded live.
In the high branches of the central tree perched a regal golden eagle. It was teased and taunted by a serpent in the roots. This place was every place and no place. It was the hollow where time and eternity met, where something and nothing came together. The serpent loved trying to get caught. It put itself in ever more compromised positions, reveling in the chase and exiting the trap. Of course, infuriating the eagle in the process. In the branches were others as well. An odd, red-breasted robin had a way of capturing the attention of those in the tree. Two owls were often present, and the robin was somehow able to bring together a condor from the south as well as a black shuck from the highlands. They would all gather in the hollow, listening to the robin as it communicated the nature of being. Naturally, the serpent challenged them. One day, when they were all gathered and listening to the robin, the serpent interrupted. It asked them if they had noticed the smoke coming from the man city. The condor replied, "Heaven is spread upon the face of the earth, yet they do not see it." "You think it that easy, then?" questioned the serpent. The others at this point joined the discussion. They, too, were ashamed of the lack of consciousness in the man city. "They remove every tree, gouge the limbs whole, destroy the soil, and fill the air with smoke," noted the eagle. "But what if it's not entirely their fault?" hissed the serpent. "They are unconscious to their place in heaven," retorted the condor. "Well then, friends." "Do you have friends, serpent?" interrupted the black dog. "I have a proposition. I have learned of a way to save man."
Welcome to 42 Minutes. Last week, there was a little May Day coup, and myself, Alan Epidessa Green, and Justin Morgan sort of seized control of the show for a little bit. I'm back again this week because we have a very, very, very special treat. We're kind of turning the tables since we're in a little coup. We're, I guess we've killed the king, and we're putting him in the hot seat. We've got Douglas Bowles, your usual host, is actually going to be the guest today. And myself and Will Morgan, we're going to be kind of putting it to him, see what it is. If he can tell us about this new book, it was just put out by Think Book Press. It was released on Saturday, May 5th, called Winter's Labyrinth. And Doug was just reading from that. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to 42 Minutes.
Good morning, Alan. Very well said. Very well said. Speaking of which, Doug, I have to ask, what was the motivation for the book? It started from one thing, but grew into a lot of things. It seems like those type of questions want to pinpoint to one, because our lives are so in sync. My whole 2011 was such that I had a number of like crises / tragedies that I had to deal with in some way, and instead of paying like a shrink $300 a week for a year, I abstracted the problems. You know, took them out of their normal realm and removed them slightly so that I could actually see them differently and created art. And that's how I kind of processed 2011, because it was kind of a heavy year for me.
Now, certain things I understood when I've read pieces of this, certain symbolism, I guess you could say, is kind of obvious, but there is some mystery to this book. There's some kind of meandering, mysticism, what's the word I'm looking for? Some very, like, almost poetic language on a metaphysical level. I'm trying to discover exactly who your influences are, because I know you're a very literature-driven person. I'm sure you read very often. That's not an assumption, is it?
No.
You're well-read is what I'm getting at. I'm wondering, for this book, who your main influences were.
Was I channeling anyone?
Yeah.
Maybe this would be, I would chalk that up to something like in the beats. You know, because with this book, it's kind of stream of consciousness. It wasn't plotted. There wasn't a whole lot of, like, left brain activity to create it. It's kind of a right brain book, and you can tell because I think what happens is, you know, the character, you're moving through the world with him, and then all of a sudden he spins off, you know, into these different flights of fancy, and as the reader, you know, you've lost almost all connection with, okay, what is the character, where is he, and what's he doing? And this is my concern as the author is hopefully when he spins off into these flights of fancy that the reader has enough of a tether to get back to the quote-unquote reality that he's experiencing.
Well, there is a sort of device here within the book is specifically the labyrinth. And I was, you know, it seems that while I was reading it, all the different spinning off onto these different tangents or flights of fancy, it seemed that it always returned back. And that seemed very indicative of the idea of the labyrinth itself. Maybe you could speak to that.
Well, and this is what's fun with art and think is that, you know, oftentimes if you have a kernel at the heart of whatever it is you're doing, that seed is going to express itself. And by having a labyrinth at the heart of this thing, it seems like the architecture and structure of the book just automatically flows into this labyrinth. And, you know, that structure is everywhere. Where the whole book is, you know, one big labyrinth.
You know, but can you explain for the listener what a difference between a labyrinth is, say, as a maze or something?
Sure. A labyrinth is a spiritual or, you know, transformative meditative device that is a circular path that moves circularly toward the middle where there's a black stone, you know, the black rock is at the middle of the labyrinth, the touchstone. And so the adept goes into the labyrinth and then the meditation begins because there is a circular path that they can't deviate from. So the purpose of the labyrinth is to just move through it, but not arriving at the center and not coming out, but kind of the whole experience. A maze is such that you enter at one point and exit at another, and then the goal of the maze is to not get trapped and to find your way out as quickly as possible. And so oftentimes people confuse a labyrinth and a maze, where with a maze there's a specific goal in mind, and that's exit. But in a labyrinth it's just the process of being there.
I was wondering about the relationship of the tree symbolism with the maze as well. I mean, why, or with the labyrinth, excuse me. Because it seems that the two major topics you're talking about is this tree, but it's very, of course, very allegorical. So how is the relationship of the tree and the labyrinth? I mean, even on the cover of the book, it kind of, they're overlaid. Are they the same thing?
Yeah. And then what's interesting is you bring in the other layer of Andras Jones's book being a tree / labyrinth that he physically runs in reality. You know, so my book begins with those animals, and they're in the tree, but they're like the serpents calling them down out of the tree and seeing if they want to participate in the mystery, you know, entering the labyrinth, so to speak. And trying to have an influence on the quote-unquote crappiness that they're seeing, you know, afar. They're commenting on all the stupid things man does. And the serpent saying, well, you know, maybe you should give it a shot. Come come on down here and let's see how, you know, what we can do to fix this.
On a broader aspect, in your own opinion, do you think that there's something malfunctioning with man, period?
Well, this is the topic of 42 minutes. So essentially, 2011 was a tragedy for me, and I needed to figure out a way to deal with the tragedy. And so what I did was wrote a book. I don't know if I wish I could tell you if the monomyth isn't inherent into part of reality and that we're going to have tragedy no matter what, and it's our job to kind of deal with it. Helen and I were talking a little bit last night about the 12
well,
monkey
it is tragedy. Life is tragedy. It's the same concept of like one a baby, like when we were talking about the whole Kubrick and the symbolism with The Shining and with the 2001, how both of them are like about a birth and a death, and how when you're born, you're going to die. Life is a tragedy. So,
well,
you're associating that with the whole world being like one child, like the mankind was born, so it will end, like mass tragedy, complete tragedy, the sinking of the Titanic.
But there's also the time machine aspect and the alchemical creating the homunculus, you know, like your the elixir of life. And so one of the things that we do is try and play with those metaphors. What does that mean? On a literal sense, if you have children, you've created a time machine that's going to go forward into the future and carry on your
past your time period.
You can, together, we will live forever. You know that line from The Fountain. And I think about that where when you get with somebody and then you create this new life, that's you moving into the future. You know, like this spaghetti monster just putting the tentacles out and seeing where, you know, you throw the rock into the pond and the ripples, you know, so you are going to have an influence on the world as it goes forward. It might not necessarily be your finite creaturely aspect, but definitely, you know, you go on forever.
So since you brought up the time aspect, I was hoping you could speak to the, I could tell in the, you know, obviously it's called Winter's Labyrinth, but very much the cycles of time are sort of, natural cycles of time are a part of the story. So for me, I didn't get the idea that it was, you know, life is a tragedy. I got the idea that there are elements of life of a sort of up and down, a rise and fall, and a natural cycle to things. And that seems, that sort of evokes the different turning paths of the labyrinth. So yes, there's going to be a time when you're making this turn, and then it turns back another way, and it's sort of a weaving. But it doesn't. I didn't get anything of being a stark, you know, oh, life is a tragedy. It just seemed more of a like, okay, now there's this, and then we deal with that, and then even when you rectify it, then maybe a new thing arises, and it's sort of always returning back in these cycles.
Yeah. Speaking to that, so within the course of a year, it would be awfully silly to mourn the loss of summer. You know, you move from summer to autumn, and it's, you know, it's a new season, and it in terms of how we live, it's a necessary season, you know, so everything's preparing to go underground or go into the underworld and to collect its essence so that it can burst forth again in the spring. You know, we're not living for the summer. We enjoy summer and it has its place, But, you know, there's a necessity to the cycle, and the same thing with life, where especially in, you know, our culture, we really, really value youth and a certain stage within the life cycle. And dying is a tragedy, but, you know, is that a tragedy viewed from the egoic summer? You know, moving through the stages is a process. And I suppose, you know, speaking about the tragedy in the book, the tragedy isn't so much that life is a tragedy. It's just that there's these things that happen that are above you, bigger than you, that you can't control, and you're going to have to deal with them in some way. And so that's the book. How do you respond to the things, the big things? Do you start a war? You know, do you become a crusader? Do you give up? You know, how do you deal with, and that's like the Titanic, Will. You know the boat's going to sink. What do you do? Do you run around with Kate Winslet and make out with her and enjoy it? You know, like Madeline Stowe says in 12 Monkeys, you know, Bruce Willis is having his revelation in the theater, and she says, you need to smell the flowers. And he's like, what flowers? You know, but she, you know, the cycle.
Now, what I know is interesting is in the book, there are elements probably kind of echoing the same exact idea where you're talking about produce, you're talking about, you know, fruits and vegetables and all the life that comes in these different cycles, how there are winter vegetables. There is a sort of constant cycle of life. It's just an ever sort of ever shifting cycle of life. But there's a real, like a, I don't know if you want to call it a subplot or, you know, what the proper phrase is, but there's this whole other element to the book of a real appreciation for food and the earth and these, you know, a sort of very literal expression of these time cycles. Where does that element come in?
As I said, so part of the experience of 2011 was me collecting my own philosophy. And so I took on a number of different perspectives earlier and then had to come up with my own understanding of these different modes of living. And I think where I've arrived is definitely an embodied philosophy of life, where spirit is very important, but it's not more important than material. So the character in the book, his process is more about being more present in material. Not, you know, part of the story is that there's this cave, and it's a 10-year-old boy that is the protagonist of Winter's Labyrinth, and he's curious about this cave. He wants to go and explore and find out what this is all about. So this is apart from his normal everyday life. And so he's so curious about this cave, he hears voices, and he wants to go and explore. But it's not because he wants to get out of his life. He just wants to bring more of this otherness into his, you know, he wants his material to be even more animated, more, and you can see that in certain individuals where there's so much presence and this aliveness in them. Like certain actors, you can see how alive they really are. You know, actualized, I guess, is the word. I don't know if that answered your question.
not directly, but I definitely think, you know, this idea of, there was someone in the chat room, and I don't know, it actually looked kind of like a troll, but, you know, just someone saying, so you must fear death if you're, you know, you're talking about this idea that you know, a realization that the Titanic's going to sink. You must fear death. Like I said, I don't.
It's the exact opposite.
Thank you. Yeah, it's like I could tell from the book. It's like it's showing a real appreciation for life and an idea that there's really nothing to fear, because even the perceived, like you said, you know, stepping into winter, you're not mourning the summer. There's this idea that will return, but you have to make the most of this too. You don't mourn the summer, but you don't long for it either. You make the most of the winter time. And there's a time and a place for that, and there's a time and a place for sort of restful or meditative, or, you know, this sort of, even a solemn state is necessary as part of a natural life cycle. And the idea that there's, the reason I asked about the produce is because you actually make a point that there are, like, you know, lettuces, there's winter produce. There is a life even in the winter. It's just different, and to learn to appreciate it. I think that's a really interesting little aspect here, showing the different foods and appreciation for them and how they are a sort of very little representation of how this continues to go. So that's why I was asking about it.
Well, okay, so that's part of, you're right, one of the undercurrents of the book is local food, the local food movement, but also natural time. And so if you're going to really live in the now, that means living where you live. And where you live, the actual land that you live on, is going to dictate how you live. We live in this global society now where everything is fair game anytime. And so there's no seasons anymore, because there's, you know, all the seasons are happening simultaneously. And so on one side, this you know, sounds wonderful, but on another, you're not really connected to your own center, because your center is where you're standing on the earth. You know, every place is a center, but wherever you are, that's the center. And so if you're eating watermelon in the middle of winter, you're not really connected to the earth. You know, you might be connected to the whole system, and, you know, perhaps.
Wait. So you've had, we've brought this up before, how oranges are a winter fruit or stuff of that nature. So,
and you can take it to an extreme, but that's exactly the point, where citrus is this wonderful, wonderful treat that you get in the winter that's coming from, you know, the places where that citrus is, it's a seasonal thing. But then in your own little corner of the world, there are all kinds of little things that you could be taking advantage of that you're not fully aware of. You know, so before refrigeration, people had to eat all these different roots in the winter, because they would store really well in the root cellars. You know, they'd have soups and stews all the time, but there are certain green things like kale that will grow, you know, that'll just, they're hardy enough to stand up to the snow, and you could go and kick the snow off and pull, you know, some of the leaves in and put that in your soup too. But there's all kinds of, you know, you get more and more microcosmic, and you can see the life around you that you could take advantage of. You know, there is a local citrus that you could take advantage of, like rose hips, where you know, and some of this is so time consuming, but, you know, worth it, where you're starting to take these little plants apart, and you get just little tiny seeds that you keep you healthy in the middle of winter.
Okay, in case you're just joining us, we're talking to Douglas Boyles, author of Winter's Labyrinth, a new book out by Sync Press. It is the 8th of May 2012, and I am going to completely switch up. Oh, first, how much time we got left?
Let's see. 24 minutes in.
24 minutes in of the 42 minutes. Wow, 24 or 42. So, to completely switch gears and to try to throw you off and off-center and make you uncomfortable, why are so many of these characters inspired by members of the Sinkhole?
That's where it started. That was the first tragedy. So past history, you know, I discovered Jake somewhere 2007 or 2008 and got into that stuff and started my own sync blog and, you know, made friends with all the Gators and then was invited to write for the sinkhole. And this was something very meaningful to me. And what happened was, in taking on that philosophy, I needed to take it apart. And so taking it apart, I think that was kind of threatening because I started questioning everything. And so at some point, to come to my own understanding of the universe, or my own interaction with the universe, let go of certain aspects of the philosophy espoused in the sinkhole. And the book kind of started from that place where, and it's funny because it grew into something completely more, but that was the initial starting point where I just needed to question some of these different philosophies. Not because I'm a hater, but just because for my own sake, my own actualization, my own, I don't even know, you know, I had to take them apart. The only way I could do it was in fiction. That I couldn't, you know, like I said, you could start a war and say, I disagree with this. But it wasn't a question of disagreeing with something. It was trying to understand. And so all my questions always came from a place of trying to find my own understanding. And so you're exactly right, Will. The beginning seems to encode members of the sinkhole as the animals in the tree.
Well, actually, one of the characters' name is Tommy, too, for the majority, and the dog's name is Arrow.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's Tommy Folk and Richard Arrowsmith. I like Richard Arrowsmith as a dog, though. That's classic. It's real classic.
It's funny, when I first started reading the book, I caught that, and then I assumed that going into chapter two, where the sort of setting changes, I assumed that these were still representations of the sinkhole. And then it was only after reading a little bit into that that I realized, oh, wait a second, this is actually, the setting has completely changed, and you go from basically examining your life, your sort of online life, and the sink explorations, and then sort of going into examining your private life, family life, community, these different farming aspects, so all this sort of stuff. And it seems like you're just, you know, going through all the different things that are sort of in your purview, let's say, and examining each of those and trying to come to terms with how things operate, how the communities operate, both an online community and how a local community operates. So I just want to throw out there, I mean, that was something where I had also caught that and then was under the assumption that it was sort of continuing and then realized that it actually didn't. So it's...
Here's one of the things that is one of my little life flaws is I have a tendency to get into dual thinking, like, and so a lot of the think stuff reminds me that it's A and B. But as we enter this, you know, the internet era, we have our online life and our real life. And from the start, one of the things that I've always been trying to do is to bring my real life and my internet life together. And so I traveled to Winnipeg, I traveled to New York, and I met all these different avatars in person because I have a hard time having these dual lives where I have my job life and all those friends. And so part of the book was trying to bring those two worlds together to see what kind of world you end up with where there isn't this separation, you know, because the internet can be like an escape in the sense that you have a secret identity and you're free from the kind of judgment you get in reality where you have people judging you about your body or your nose or your hair or your teeth and things, because in the internet you can craft your own persona, your own, you know, you create. And so that's why it's so exciting and fun. But at the same time, you know, some of these different imaginal worlds end up being traps where part of the aliveness of life is lost in the process of abstracting yourself into this created character that you play.
I've seen individuals who've created almost like whole communities just to fool people, like on Facebook and stuff. I mean, what do you think the relationship to what you're talking about now, as far as like a cyber neurosis, you know, a splitting of the identity because of the internet?
Right, and how real are these Facebook personas? You know, Facebook is one of these really strange things where it's the same thing that I was talking about, where we had our blogger identities and then our real lives. Now, you know, I would say norms, they have their Facebook identity, and this is the person that they're trying to sell to everyone, and then their real identity. You know, how much do they manipulate their Facebook profile to create the person that they want other people to see? I don't
know. I still think you danced around the influence question, man. Who are your major influences? Who are your favorite writers?
I'm all over the place. I'm trying to think.
Short recommended reading list. Short recommended reading. Five. Top five.
Well, I've been really reading a lot of Philip K. Dick lately. So in the book, Tommy talks about Hamlet and Moby Dick. And then, so the huge books in my life are Moby Dick, definitely, and Parsifal by Eschenbach, you know, so these classic mythological stories that contain entire universes are ones that I've really locked on to. But, you know, through my own journey, there's lots of things that have been meaningful, like Stephen King's Dark Tower series. Stephen King is one of those authors that, boy, I love him and I hate him because he's so good and so bad at the same time. As far as, like, having, you know, like, favorites right now, I just go where the path leads me. And so I read lots of different things. I've been reading this book called New World Monkeys now forever. I've been reading so slow because I'm always reading about three or four books simultaneously, depending on what strikes me.
What are your views on Think? I mean, I don't think that I've really, like, listened to your opinion on what we've talked about. Conspiracy, we've talked about, you know, the Unimus, we've talked about the Think Rapture. I mean, where's your standing? What are we dealing with?
I don't know if we're ever going to know that, and that's why we have to explore and play, because the result is our own, the product of the play. But it helps other people play at the same time. So I like questions, but I don't know if we're going to ever come to answers that are satisfying as answers. You know, we come to something that leads us to the next question, and we continually unpack the mystery. But I don't know if I'm of the opinion that the mystery can be known, that part of the mystery is part of the admission, or it's part of what, it's the stage. You know, and as soon as you unveil the stage, all of a sudden, so Moby Dick, they have really, really wanted to know the capital T truth, and he was willing to into the whale at the end of the story. Does he know the truth? Maybe. Who knows? We don't know because we're still alive. So maybe he, and this is that sink rapture thing, where if that's the goal, knowing the mystery, then I think the price of gnosis is losing our creatureliness. You know, so right now we're immaterial, and if the goal is gnosis, perhaps achieving the goal is death or transcending life as we, and it seems like to me, from what I've encountered, the goal is actually becoming more alive, not, you know, so we chase the whale because it's fun, but we're, you know, to have the game, we have to chase the whale. Going inside the whale is game over from where we're standing. That's my thought. And then as far as conspiracy, I think the conspiracy is too big. This is where I arrived years ago, where if you go down the rabbit hole, you realize that everyone is in on it, and it's too big to be orchestrated by anyone other than the universe.
Like the collective unconscious, you know,
sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, like, it's perpetrated by the collective unconscious, like Jung or Freud would say. Like, it's...
Yeah. I've actually been reading Jose Arguelles' Manifesto of the Noosphere, and it's really interesting from that standpoint, where the idea that life is evolving towards a larger, instead of a collective unconscious, it's a collective conscious, collective consciousness, which is kind of what we're playing with Sync.
You would still argue that there's still something separate from that. It's not to break things down to semantics, but not purely a collective consciousness. There somehow exists both collective consciousness and individual consciousness. It's a paradox I'm comfortable with. I think that's something I've come to, but I'm just curious.
Conscious, unconscious. There's like a division line. We each have, because the whole concept of unconscious is everything that happens that you're not aware of is part of the unconscious. All dead would be unconscious. I was thinking about this the other day, because that's the whole concept of this esoteric human sacrifice, is like the whole concept or theory about human sacrifice is to bank the collective unconsciousness. Because everybody who dies becomes of what we are not conscious of. They become part of the unconscious, so stored in the unconscious. And that's how synchronicity works and everything like that, is because it's still just a part of you that you're unconscious of moving. I don't know.
Does that make sense? That's what I've been getting out of it. Reading a lot of Jung, reading a lot of Freud, and I've kind of like synthesized them together and came up with my own theory. It's like everything that you're unconscious of is your unconsciousness.
From my standpoint, one of the things that I've looked at in the book and in my life is the idea of evil. And I don't know how much evil there really is if it isn't just unconsciousness. There's definitely people utilizing or oppressing other people intentionally, but a lot of the nastiness that happens in life is just unconsciousness. You know, we're not aware of how our actions affect other people. And so that's the goal of Tommy's journey, is becoming more conscious of the larger world that he participates in. You know, being more aware of how his life is part of the larger world, and that how his actions affect other people.
Okay, so we're on our way out for sure. It's been about 42 minutes. I just wanted to make sure that you give out some of your blog spots, because you've been a host on this show and you've never done that, I don't think. So go ahead and tell people where they can find your blogs.
You find Winner's Labyrinth at thesyncbook.com and on Amazon, and that's a good place for that. I'm writing at The Mask of God right now. I think it's themaskofgod.blogspot.com. And I also have a blog.
I believe it's The Mask of God.
Okay. And then is it The Experience? What is it? I don't even know. Let's see. It's experiencebeingalive.blogspot.com. And that's where I'm doing mostly thinking about literature on, it's called An Experience of Being Alive. And you can find that on Amazon too, because it's linked there to my author profile at the book. Those are the places where you can find my thoughts. And I think that's it. So that's 42 minutes. Thank you, Will.
And you, Doug. Thanks, Alan.
Oh, no problem. Really good listening to you guys.
Yeah. And next week it'll be a surprise, and buy my book. I think you'll enjoy it. Thank you so much.
Syncbookpress.com.
Take care.